Thank you for joining us in this kind of late night session. It's 5 o'clock, so this is a bit of a late one. My name is Chris Hallam. I'm the Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. So I own pretty much all the security technologies that are in the Windows client. So there's things like BitLocker, AppLocker, ALSR, DAP, you know, all the things that are there to keep the client secure. And if those technologies are shared in server, then I kind of own those scenarios as well. And so today we're going to talk about what's new in blue, or Windows 8.1 is what we're now calling it. And so we're going to go through and we're going to first start with a quick discussion on what we shipped in 8. So a lot of people are still looking at 8 for the first time, so we want to make sure you know what the key parts of that product are, so you know the value proposition. We'll talk about the impact of Windows 8. We've just recently got some really interesting information back from the Trustworthy Computing Group that shows the progress we've made from a security perspective when it comes to malware, and there's some pretty dramatic results that we're going to share there. We'll then talk about how the landscape is changing. As we went through the Windows 8 product cycle, we started to see almost a seismic shift in the types of attacks that we're seeing, and we expect to see that continue, so we'll talk about that. And then we'll get into the meat of the presentation, which is what's new. So with that, let's kind of recap what we delivered with 8. So when we set out to build Windows 8, one of the key things we wanted to do is we wanted to make sure that we delivered the most substantial set of security improvements in Windows 8 that we'd ever done in a single release. So if we were to quantify these, this would be similar to what we did between XP all the way to Windows 7. So we decided to do that in a single release. We were able to do that because we added the manpower to the effort, and we funded it. And so it's no surprise that we did it in a single release because that was our goal, and we staffed accordingly. But it was substantial, as you can imagine. And so one of the big investment areas and one of our goals was to deliver groundbreaking malware resistance. So we wanted to make sure that Windows 8 was not just a little bit better when it came to malware. We wanted to make sure that it was much better. And we achieved that goal, as you'll see here in a few minutes. The way we approached it is by eradicating entire classifications of malware. So when we think about rootkits and bootkits, which are some of the most sophisticated, those have been all but eliminated, and in some cases even entirely eliminated. We'll see what happens in the future. We can never predict what people will do to these defenses, but we've provided an architectural solution to the problem rather than just a software solution that tries to make it difficult. So that's the big game changer there. When it comes to securing the code in the core, we've really made a lot of advancements when it comes to our code quality. The security development lifecycle is a process that all of our engineers go through, and we started that back in XP when we had Blaster and Slammer and all these things kind of surprise us. I think the level of engineering maturity in this level has increased dramatically, and in fact, if you look at the, I think it's a Q3 Kaspersky report, which enumerates applications that have vulnerabilities in it, Microsoft sadly was in the top 10 for a long time. It's no longer there, which is great. So that's great news. The thing I think is most interesting, other than the fact that we're not there, is if you look at the total volume of code, you look at the surface area, and you compare that versus the things that are in that list now, I think it makes it kind of a dramatic achievement because Windows is enormous compared to everything else. So it's actually in some respects surprising that we ever fell off a list. But I think it speaks to the quality of what we're doing. There were a number of other things that we could go into, but I don't want to waste our time on just Windows 8. I think what we can say is groundbreaking is not hyperbole. I think it was a huge improvement. When it comes to protecting sensitive information, our goal is to make sure that delivering encryption to a device is something that everybody does. Today, when I talk to customers, you often see only the laptops in their organizations being encrypted with BitLocker or Symantec or McAfee, whatever the technology you use is. And in our view, that's not good enough. You need encryption not only to protect data that is likely to be lost, like on mobile, you actually need it to protect the bits on the system as well. If somebody has access to the Windows files or your application files, there you can tamper with those. So it's not just about the information on the device, it's about the apps and even the system core itself. We made a lot of improvements to make it super easy to provision BitLocker. That's the big improvement there. BitLocker is probably the best, and we don't have statistical information to prove this, but when you compare it versus 7, it's dramatically better than what we've seen in the past on BitLocker and other solutions. So it's very easy, if not brain dead, to provision encryption on these devices. You could actually see 10, 20, 30 times, maybe even more, performance improvement during the provisioning process because of those improvements. And actually, it was the amount of time it took to provision encryption that prevented people from deploying in the first place. So now that it's easy, we think that it will be pervasive. When it comes to modern access control, One of the things we're trying to do, you probably remember the Matt Honan article, the article about killing the password. If you're not familiar with it, this person had their account breached. It started at Amazon, it then went to Apple, and then they ended up inside Matt's bank accounts because they were able to compromise the Amazon account and then cascade through a number of other accounts. So anyway, what he showed is that passwords are increasingly problematic. And with Windows 8, we of course kind of knew this was coming, and so we delivered a multi-factor authentication option called virtual smart cards that basically allows you to use your device as a physical smart card rather than a card or some other type of multi-factor option. This can be electronically provisioned, which makes it easy to provision this, and that's actually one of the reasons why people don't use multi-factor. It requires a card, it might be expensive, it's challenging to manage. Well, with virtual smart cards, it's very easy. Comparatively speaking. So that's a great solution there. Another feature we did is called dynamic access control. And our goal with dynamic access control was to move away from static lists for access control. So you can imagine that if I have a file share, that file share has a relationship with a security group, and then I add users and I remove users over time. The challenge there, that's a static list, and somebody has to keep that list up to date. And in a large organization, that doesn't happen. In fact, about 15 years ago when I first started at Microsoft, I added access to some shares. I shouldn't have access anymore, and guess what, 15 years later, I still have access to those old resources because nobody has time to revoke access generally unless it's really required. So most organizations fail in their attempts to do this, and so dynamic access control moves us away from a static list to a dynamic rules-based policy. So I define rules and I leverage properties of the user and the device, things that are stored in Active Directory, and access control operates on those. So if you have a user who's working on, let's say, a project, if that data is in Active Directory, the second that person leaves that project and Active Directory is updated, they instantly lose access to those resources. So somebody doesn't have to think about individuals anymore. They think about the attributes of users. So lots of big improvements there. So let's talk about mail resistance, which was really the hero of the Windows 8 release, and let's talk about the improvements that we made there. This chart divides things into two areas. So we have statistics coming in, or telemetry data coming in that shows us the amount of malware that's hitting unprotected PCs, meaning they're not running or do not have an active version of an anti-malware solution. And then we also are able to see the impact on protected PCs. So for PCs that are unprotected, we find that for every 1,000 PCs on Windows 8, 2.7 of them are going to have some sort of malware on them. If we compare that versus Windows 7, it's about three times more, and then if we move to XP, it's more dramatic. It's about 5+. When we have anti-malware solution involved, we go down to 0.2, so that's a pretty good number. When we compare it to 7, it's six times. Is that six? Yes, yeah, so six times more likely to be impacted with malware. If we compare it to XP, it's 21 times less likely to be impacted. So we can attribute many of these improvements in 8 because of things like ALSR, Trusted Boot, Secure Boot. There's a long list of other things. But I think we did kind of hit a home run when it comes to improving the malware resistance capabilities of platforms. So this in isolation is probably a reason for you to be considering Windows 8, especially with the threat landscape we're dealing with. So let's talk about how that change is actually going on. So it's time to reassess the threat. And I know with every release of Windows or any new innovation, we say, oh, the landscape's changing and you know, we need to be scared about the new things. We are seeing really somewhat seismic shifts in what's going on. And part of it's because of what I just talked about. The resistance to malware that we have in our system now has caused people to move in some ways away from that. They haven't stopped thinking about malware, but they're thinking a lot more about spear phishing, you know, phishing types of attacks, social engineering, on and on. Attacking the public key infrastructure itself is something that we foresee. And so so with that, there's really kind of two types of organizations. Based on the types of attacks we've seen, really towards the beginning of the Windows 8 cycle, we started to see this trend. And we know now that there are organizations who realize they've been hacked and they've talked about it maybe publicly or not. And then the rest of the organizations who don't know they've been hacked just don't realize it yet. And this is probably a fairly true statement, and I'll tell you why here in a minute. There's these threats that are very familiar that we've been talking about forever. There's always this evolution of threats and an evolution of countermeasures, and we're just in this hamster wheel, constantly kind of band-aiding things or patching things and moving the ball on the attackers. But now we're dealing with a totally different type of threats. Threats that are modern and by modern actors, right? It's not the same people who are attacking systems like we're used to. It's a completely different type of person. And so let's kind of compare and contrast the familiar versus modern. So we've talked about the script kiddies, right? And they're kind of posers, actually, right? Because they just rip off other people's ideas and replicate them. But we also have cyber criminals, and they've been able to pull off some interesting things. There's been some innovation there. But now we have a different type of thing. We're dealing with cyber warfare and cyber espionage. And last week, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, last week there was an article in the Washington Post. It's pretty scary about the type of things that cyber in these two areas. When it comes to cyber criminals, right, we're familiar with them, but now we're talking about state-sponsored actors. And the knee-jerk reaction when I say state-sponsored actors is people go, well, I didn't say that, but your other knee-jerk reaction would be, oh, well, I don't work for the Department of Defense. It's not a problem for me, right? Right, that's what a lot of people tell me all the time. Well, guess what? If you don't need to work for the Department of Defense to be worried about a nation state going after you. But the key thing with these nation states is they also have unlimited resources. Right? They literally have factories now of people who are thinking about how to attack organizations. The familiar is us solving problems in software. Right? We add more and more defenses over time. Well, the modern is you can't be safe enough unless you have modern hardware, right? That hardware is UEFI and that's TPM. And there are other technologies too that we'll talk about today, like biometrics. But if you're using older PCs that don't have things like UEFI, TPM, you can't get the full benefit of Windows 8. You can run 8 and you'll be safer than you were on 7. But I don't know if you can really be safe against some of the modern threats that you're going to be encountering, if not already, but in the future here. When it comes to securing the perimeter, that's something that we've always done, right? But if you remember the Bushehr Iranian nuke facility, they have an air gap network, and guess what? Stuxnet got in there. So no wireless connectivity, no wires to the outside, and yet somehow a terrible virus got inside that and compromised their efforts. And then we're familiar with attacks on Fortune 500. But now it's all sectors, and even small businesses are being attacked. It's no longer just the Department of Defense and Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics, et cetera. So anyway, and the last thing here is I hope I don't get hacked, but you will, and so you need to find out how you're going to mitigate this and how successful were you. So a couple quotes, and then we're going to switch into the meat on blue, but I think these are interesting here. So last year, in response to Flame, F-Secure, who probably many of you know about, said this. They basically said, that the security products and the antivirus products that we're using were not designed to protect you against the digital equivalent of SEAL Team 6. Right, so think about that for a minute. We all know who they are, SEAL Team 6 is now and the level of precision and capability they have. Those are the types of people we're dealing with. And this is not anonymous that we're talking about here. Those guys are cyber thugs, right? These are a different type of people with a totally different level of IQ and funding. This is another interesting article out of Tech Republic's article where they were talking about Verizon's data breach investigation report, which many people don't know about, but this thing is a treasure trove of information. If you want to know what's going on, you should be looking at this. But what they're saying here is these companies who think that they're too small to be targets are totally wrong, and they have all the data to prove that it's not just Fortune 500, it's not Fortune 1000, it's even small businesses are being attacked. And they're being attacked oftentimes for the identities of their users. And the last one here is related to the article I mentioned a little bit ago, which is came from the Washington Post. The title is pretty long, so I'm not going to read it, but basically the article is about how some of the most top secret defense projects, the specifications for things like the F-35, missile defense, on, these things have been compromised, and it wasn't Lockheed necessarily. This was actually pretty much anybody working on defense projects, but Lockheed did supply an interesting quote. And they said they're spending more time helping deal with attacks on their supply chain than they are on themselves, because people know that Lockheed's got great defenses. So how are we going to get into Lockheed? Well, we'll get into Lockheed by hacking into the company that makes nuts and bolts for them. Right? So nobody in the supply chain working with Lockheed is safe, and their employees aren't safe either, because if you can hack an employee's personal computer, guess what? You can get into Lockheed that way too, maybe. So anyway, so it's a very different space we're in, and so there's a little bit of doom and gloom here. And so I'm going to skip through some of these last slides so we can get into the meat here. But we have a great set of new capabilities in 8.1 that are going to deal with a lot of these modern threats. Now, malware resistance was the big hero in Windows 8, and it deserves that crown, but we're going to move that into the area where we think attacks are moving, which is more into the identity space. So modern access control is the hero, and that's where we put the most effort, I think, in the release. And so we're going to go through almost, in fact, we'll go through every single one of these, but a couple things that I think are, when they come up on the slides, that are worth paying attention, our work on biometrics, trustworthy identities. Those are things that are big investments that we're going to go into in some detail. There's an area called Provable PC Health, which is a cloud-based service that's going to help analyze PCs and determine the integrity that they have. And the things we're doing in protecting sensitive data, which is pervasive and device encryption, which I'll explain a little later. And then we also have a capability called Selective Wipe to help remove corporate data off of devices when the relationship between a user and an entity ends. Also, within trustworthy hardware, I mentioned UEFI and TPM. Those were around Windows 8. Modern biometric readers, which we'll show you today, are another part of that hardware initiative. So let's talk about TPM first, and then which is our hardware piece. And so TPM, as many of you know, has been around for quite a while. We took advantage of it in Windows 7. We used it primarily for BitLocker. In Windows 8, we started to use it across a much broader array of functionality. I think there might have been 10 or more features taking advantage of it. Things like virtual smart cards, BitLocker continued to use it. ALSR actually used it to increase the entropy of memory to help protect against vulnerabilities and making sure that they can't be exploited. We used it in a number of areas. But the problem with TPM was it was really a commercial feature, right? You had it on your commercial devices, but it wasn't guaranteed. Maybe it was there, maybe it wasn't. It was on most devices at this point, but maybe a few years ago, it still was on a subset. And so with Windows 8.1, the things in the hardware industry have lined up such that we're gonna have TPM become pervasive on all devices, including all consumer devices. Part of that's gonna happen this Wednesday when Intel, releases more information on their Haswell processor. So they've announced that I think on the 4th, which is tomorrow, that they're going to talk about Haswell today. Okay, I should know that since I'm here. But at any rate, Haswell will include PTT, Platform Trust Technology, which allows us to put firmware-based TPM in that generic security component. They probably wouldn't like me calling it generic, but it's a general-purpose security component, right? And so since Haswell will be used on most PCs, that means that all consumer devices pretty much are going to have this technology. So this is exciting news, and because of that, we're going to be able to use TPM in a number of other scenarios, right? A lot of our activity on TPM is kind of gated on the adoption, and now that it's going to be pervasive everywhere, you're going to see a lot more utilization. So this next year, starting this year, it will become pervasive. Next year, almost all devices will have TPM. In 2015, we will make it a requirement. No Windows devices will get certified unless they have this technology. Go ahead, question.
So PTT completely replaces the TPM chip?
No. Well, the PTT provides this security component, and we can basically build a firmware-based version of TPM. So it has the same functionality as TPM, but it's not a discrete part on the motherboard. And because of this, it drives the cost down to zero, which is one of the main gating factors. So the TPM, when it's in a discrete form, can be, to the OEMs, it's a lot of money. It's at least several dollars, if not more. So this represents, firmware-based TPM represents huge profit margin gains in a lot of cases.
My question would be, can you create virtual smart cards based on the PTT?
Absolutely. So you have firmware TPM. Firmware TPM from a Windows perspective, think of it as identical to discrete. It has exactly the same capability, except it's free. So it's a good thing. And so now it's going to be on commercial devices or consumer devices. And what's interesting there is it opens up the potential for like virtual smart cards. Imagine a bank being able to provision you a virtual smart card and killing the password in the process. So those are exciting scenarios that can happen when we see the device turnover happen. So pretty exciting stuff there. We've also seen some progress in Russia and China. TPM has had restrictions in those regions. The TPM 2.0 has a feature called crypto agility, which basically allows additional encryption algorithms to be added to the processor. This works with the firmware-based version as well. And so now China and Russia are open to the idea of TPM for the first time. There's still some work to do with those governments to get them to officially sanction it and, you know, put that on their sleeves. But we're very optimistic, and we have indicators that that's all going to happen You need to work with your legal departments before you send people in that region with TPM devices, because I think we're in a mixed state right now. But we've made a lot of progress versus where we were a year ago. So, so pretty good news on that front. So let's get into our first area of modern access control, which is one of the big themes. It's the big hero this time. And let's talk about biometrics. And so, as I mentioned earlier with the Matt Honan example, right, we want to move away from passwords. And so virtual smart cards were a step. Well, we're going to take another step, and we're going to move towards biometrics. So biometrics has a long history in the Windows platform. We've had a framework, but that framework has been incomplete, right? It doesn't include enrollment experience for the different types of devices out there, and it really required third-party capability to be added to the product in order for it to work. My Lenovo device has a swipe reader. I use it because it makes sense for the security guy to be using this type of technology, but I would look at around the company, I'll find most people don't use that even though it's there. And it's simply because they have to go get more software to do it, and it comes from a third party. So what we're trying to do in 8.1 is we want to make sure that, use of biometrics, fingerprint-based biometrics, is the best solution. It's the best experience. It provides faster logons, more security, et cetera. We want to make sure there's no friction in this movement towards biometrics. And by doing that, we can get people to use it, right? Because if you add new friction, then people don't adopt, right? Like the swipe readers with my Lenovo, there's too much friction in getting third-party software. So we want to take all the friction out of it, and then the adoption will happen. And we want to drive adoption in consumer and enterprise scenarios. And so there's a number of different technology choices out there for readers, and there's some questions about them. You've all heard about different people hacking on these. Hacking is probably the wrong word. Spoofing, fake fingers. The image I see here that you see here on the right is from a case down in Brazil. There was a series of doctors, and they had to basically use time card type scenarios. They logged into work, and that's when they start to get paid. And so there are a group of five of these guys, and they all created silicone imprints of each other's thumbs. And three of them would show up to work, and the other two would go do something else. They'd probably go to the beach or go to the bar, watch football, do something else. But meanwhile, they're getting paid because somebody else signed them in with a fake finger. And this is totally true, by the way. There's an article. And here's a better picture of what they use. These pictures come from the Brazilian authorities. They publish these pictures, and so that just gives you an idea. They were using an optical reader, right? That's how they were able to fake that system. That's basically a 2D image. Yeah, and that silicone finger looks like the same on 2D as it would in real life. So it's pretty interesting. It's kind of a fun part of the presentation. But anyway, a modern reader does not have these problems. A modern reader has what we call liveness detection. Liveness detection has the ability to differentiate between a finger that is dead, like this one here. This is from a morgue somewhere where they took some fingerprints. And then this is what a live fingerprint would look like. From more of like a 2D perspective. So you'll see that the moisture of the finger, the fact that if there's moisture inside the hand itself or the thumb, that it creates a very different imprint than somebody that's drying out. So at any rate, so a modern reader has the ability to detect this, and they can do it through a number of ways. Moisture, electrocardiogram, there's a long list of different ways they can kind of detect liveness. They can actually look at fingers from a 3D point of view, etc. And a modern reader is also touch-based, in our opinion. So you're used to seeing the swipe-based readers. Let me show you a modern one here. Oops, I'm on the wrong number here. So swipe-based requires you to swipe the finger. They're the ones you see on your Lenovos, and some other people are selling it. Now this is a device, a non-production device from Fingerprint Cards. We have a couple people from the company here who can answer some Q&A here at the end, but what you see here is a prototype device, and the thing that's important here is what you see in the middle. This is that touch-based service, and so if I want to sign in with my biometric identity, if it was a swipe device, I would move my finger here, and then it wouldn't work the first time, and then I would do it again, and eventually it would work out. With this, I can do this in about 1 second, and I can sign in. So this has a very high-performance way of taking a look. It has all those liveness detection options that I just talked about. This is what a modern reader's like, right? There's no friction in this device. I just touch and I'm authenticated, whereas with swipe-based, I have all this kind of cumbersomeness. So this type of device is superior, and this will appear on keyboards. It will be on all-in-ones. It will be on laptops. It will be on tablets. We don't have any announcements to make today on who's committed to putting them in which devices and which way, because people are still trying to make those decisions. But that's where the future is, and that's not a long ways in the future. That's stuff that we'll start to see out coming out this year. So let me show you what the experience... is. Okay. All right. So I'm at my logon screen here. And as I mentioned, this is super fast. What's interesting here is if I'm not logged on, let's say I've just rebooted my PC or I have multiple users logged on, basically the sign-in experience is going to figure out which profile to get into based on my biometric identity. So I don't have to flip the lock screen up and then select a profile and then go somewhere, right? It adds a little more friction, a little more complexity. I can put my finger down in like less than a second. I'm now into my profile. So this adds a lot of efficiency, and like you know, I mentioned that the way we're going to get people to use this is because the experience is so much better. This is a lot better, and it's going to be a lot better when it's sitting on my Surface keyboard, which it's not there yet, but I'm hoping it will be. But anyway, so a much better way of signing in. In addition to being able to sign in on Windows Logon, you'll also be able to sign in any of the experiences that you would expect. So if I'm using VPN or connecting to Direct Access or all the places where you might need to provide that type of authentication, you'll use your biometric identity. Another thing we've done, and I'm kind of getting ahead of my slides here, but that's okay. I'd rather spin it here in the demo, is we've also added API support so you can add biometric verification in an application itself. So you can imagine a scenario like we have here. I have this little dollar sign app. This is like, imagine this is my Fidelity banking account or my U.S. Bank or Bank of America. What you could do is you can hook into the, What you can do is you can take advantage of the APIs, and then your biometric identity can be used to sign in. So you can imagine, like, if you hand your device to your daughter or your son or whatever, it's because you want them to be able to surf the internet or whatever. They're logged on as you. They have your credentials, and they now can use all of your apps. So we can now add this API that allows you to verify the user before you actually go into individual apps. Now, you could do that with a password today. There's nothing preventing people from doing that, but because of that friction that's there, nobody would ever do it, right? People would want the, hey, how can I save my password feature so I don't have to be annoyed with the password, and then you lose the security. So with biometrics, what's going on here? Okay. With biometrics, I can, of course, quickly sign in to my app. Now, the API can be used anywhere. It can be used on startup of the app, but it also could be within app functions. So in this case, in the case of this app, imagine this is gives me the ability to trade my Contoso shares or my Microsoft shares. I may allow people to get into the application because it may have some read-only functions that don't require user verification, but maybe when it comes down to selling something or accessing information within the app, like an account balance, maybe it would ask for an additional identity. So if I had a trade shares button or a sell 100% of my shares option, I could hook that biometric verification into that as well. Go ahead.
Is this API for modern apps or for all apps?
It's for modern apps, yes. Yeah. So anyway, so pretty cool stuff there. So let's go back to our presentation here. And I've kind of quickly gone through a couple slides in advance. There's a couple things we've added. So in addition to the Windows sign-in, we also have a concept that we call Touch to Buy. And Touch to Buy basically is where we've added that API support in the Windows Store, Xbox Music, video, et cetera. And so we would expect third parties might take advantage of this API and add it through their own things. Wes, you had a question there.
I do. You mentioned that 8.1 is enhancing the significant, and I recognize the advancements in the peripherals. Mm-hmm.
There's actually one thing that I didn't take the time to show, but since you asked, we can move back actually to the demo. Something I kind of blazed past actually is the thing that was lacking on my Lenovo was the ability to enroll my identity. And so we've actually added that functionality directly in the box here. So let me go in here. And so I can go into my account and then my sign-in options. And so you'll see that I can add a finger. So if I didn't have any enrolled, it would say, you know, add a finger identity. But in this case here, I can add an additional. I can select that option. It's going to verify, so we're using our own API here. We don't want somebody who has access to the box to register themselves as you. So we verify your identity. So I'm now able to then swipe another finger or add one for the first time. Now, if I had a swipe-based reader, instead of having four there, where it's going to basically ask me to verify up to four times for this touch-based reader, it could be up to 10 times because they're just not as accurate. So I can go ahead and roll a new finger, one, and it'll probably work on the second one because these readers from fingerprint cards are so high-performance and they're very accurate, they don't need me to go through. Other devices may work differently. But this one's obviously pretty good. So we're always going to do at least two so we can at least make sure that we didn't make a mistake on that first image capture. So now I've added that, and now I can sign up. I can sign in with, I guess, now up to four fingers since I've done that. So it's the enrollment experience is the big add. The additional ways to sign in with biometrics across Windows is also the second piece. And then there's also driver things that we've done as well to help people like fingerprint cards. Okay, so I guess I didn't follow. So,
just like sometimes we encrypt and require a separate password for a folder.
Okay. Okay, so the scenario would be rather than using the identity, my fingerprint, my index finger, that I might use a different finger altogether. Right. Okay, right. And so, I probably didn't explain this correctly. So the API that I was discussing earlier can be added to any app at any capacity. So any app function, any task can be gated with that additional biometric verification. Okay, so there is a capability. Okay. There is a capability where an application can cloak, I think is the word we're using, Nelly. So the app can leverage this API and then can cloak that data, and then it would require verification, biometric verification, before it would be able to be loaded in an app. So we do have that capability. I don't know, Nelly, if you want to add to that, that's a feature we weren't covering today specifically. Thank you, Nelly. All right, so let's see here.
One question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So that thing that you showed about enrolling your fingers or making them available, you need to do that locally on your machine, right?
Correct.
Because on Windows 7, I've had customers that when I tell them about the functionality of validating any UAC prompts using the finger, they told me, well, that could be really useful for our help desk staff over-the-shoulder authentication without typing in the password. But of course, there's no centralized way of giving access to all machines for a specific thing. Let's say administrator account.
Okay. Nelly, you were about to say something, so I'll defer to you. Yeah. Storing it in like Active Directory, as cool as that could be, it would cause huge, huge, huge problems. So we don't go there, as cool as it would be.
Is there a policy that can be said that you must enroll your fingerprint to be able to have access to that device or something like that?
I'm not aware of a policy that does just that. Is there any policy that you can set so that it requires biometrics to log in as opposed to maybe a virtual smart card or a password, Nelly? Is there anything like that? Okay. All right, so we. Okay, well, speaking of virtual smart cards, so that's our next slide, actually. So, way to tee it up. Okay, so you're familiar with virtual smart cards. Virtual smart cards are basically, we're able to provision a certificate, we model it as a smart card reader and a smart card itself. It's always plugged in, it leverages the TPM, so it's protected, it's always there. And so this is a great way to add multi-factor authentication to your scenario, because a physical smart card and readers is often cumbersome and hard to deploy, it's expensive, et cetera. So they're a great solution, and people are very interested in them. Where they're particularly interested in them is in non-domain join scenarios. And with Windows 8, we didn't do great work there. And so we needed to improve the APIs so that you could easily provision a virtual smart card to a non-domain join or a BYOD device. And so we've added that in Windows 8. And so this is really going to create the opportunity now that TPM is going mainstream. For that banking scenario that I mentioned earlier. Before on Windows 8, you probably couldn't have achieved that. Technically, it could have been done, but it probably would never have been actually provisioned that way. So good news on the virtual smart card front. That's probably the one big improvement worth mentioning. In fact, I'm going to, just in the interest of time, I'm going to skip this particular demo because it basically is a small UI, and I type in a password, and we end up with a virtual smart card. But I want to make sure we can spend time with some other areas. Another area, and this is mentioned earlier, this is a significant area, is about trustworthy identities and devices. And so because malware, we've done great work there, we see people going after public key infrastructure, and so we want to add trustworthiness into this, this security technology that we are increasingly dependent on. And so the challenges with certificate trustworthiness are the breaches are difficult to detect when they happen, right? Because when somebody steals a certificate and he's using it, how do you know, right? That's an actual authentic representation of your identity, right? There's really no easy way to determine that. So when this happens, it often takes a long time to identify these things. And so there's a number of famous cases. So about a year and a half ago, DigiNotar, which is a certificate authority, was duped into issuing authentic certificates to somebody, a malicious user, for Yahoo and Google and a number of other companies. And then later on, what happened? They set up some web servers on the internet, and they poisoned DNS to redirect users to them. And then from there, they're stealing identities, they're provisioning malware devices, and nobody knows what's really going on until later. And so DigiNotar is now out of business because their main business of trust was completely breached. And so that company no longer exists. But in this case here, what's interesting is somebody stole authentic certs. The case of Stuxnet's a case where somebody actually went into breached the security of a building and ended up stealing the certificates, and then they were able to use those to sign things. So Stuxnet's a slightly different thing. We have Flame, where a collision attack was used, and I think we used the MD5 encryption algorithm to create that certificate, and with this collision attack, they were able to duplicate what looked like an authentic certificate when it was not, but to most systems, it would appear just fine. So Flame was really interesting. A thing like Flame would evade technologies like UEFI and Trusted Boot because those bits were signed by us, at least it looked that way. And then Mimikatz is something that is a tool that you can use to export certificates from a system, right? Even if they're marked non-exportable, right? So this shouldn't be able to happen, but if you're an admin with physical access and you have a tool like this, you can steal private keys from PCs and then you can be that user or that device, etc. So these are kind of some famous cases and tools. And so what did these breaches depend on? Well, the key problem with public key infrastructure is it's entirely based on this assumption that those private keys and those certificates have never fallen into the wrong hands. And when it does, then you have a huge problem. So what we need to do is we need to increase the trustworthiness of this system and help manage the hygiene in the internet so that we're using certificates in the internet. And we also need to create the condition where certificates are issued by corporations or banks or et cetera, the security of those can be determined. And that's something we really can't do today. And so to determine the security of certificates that may be provisioned to devices, maybe a certificate or that represents your identity, we're adding a feature called TPM key attestation. So when a certificate comes down to your PC and you want to use, let's say it's your identity and you want to access some resource, the resource, as long as that identity looks okay, it's going to say, hey, that's fine, go ahead and grab access to anything you want. Whether that's a tampered with certificate or a certificate that has maybe been exported with Mimikatz, the service doesn't care, right? It just cares that you have this identity. What we want to do is create the condition where the certificate, it can be determined whether the certificate was securely provisioned to the device and then secured by the TPM, right? Because when we secure it with the TPM using TPM KSP, we know that a tool like Mimikatz can't export the certificate and replay it somewhere else. And so, and not only that, when you try to use that identity to connect to a resource, they can add access control policy on top of it that will deny access, even if you have an identity, if you cannot prove that that identity was actually secured in the TPM KSP itself. So this creates a condition where we know that the certificate has been provisioned securely and that it's being used in a non-fraudulent way. And this is something that's a pretty big improvement that we're going to have. And I think that this is going to kind of head off where we think future attacks are going to happen. We're not seeing this happening at scale today, but we think that that might happen in the future. Go ahead, question? Should work just the same. Not going to work with virtual machines, Nellie? Oh, I'm sorry, because the TPM doesn't work with... Yeah, absolutely, sorry. I was thinking about the certificates themselves. Yes, absolutely not. Thank you, Nellie. Yes, we need a TPM, and we don't have that on a virtual machine, of course. Excellent question.
So is there any kind of
virtual
TPM?
No, sadly not. So I'm not sure. We don't have anything to disclose on what we're doing on that front, but that's something that we don't have at this point. Well, the problem, so PTT is you might think it's virtual, it's firmware-based, but it's basically going to marry that PC to that instance of Windows, and now you have another, and so you can't have multiple operating system instances sharing that TPM. Okay, so that's what we're going to do to deal with a lot of corporate certificates. Well, what about public certificates and keys that are being used in the cloud? So when you go to a website, whether it's Microsoft.com or Google or name your favorite site, they give you a certificate and you're able to verify the identity of that site. And you see that in your browser, and your browser will be green when you know, okay, it looks like this site is authentic. Now, the case of DigitNotar, because they stole somebody's certificates, you would get the green light anyway, even though you're being duped. And so that's the problem that we're trying to address with this new feature. We have a feature called Certificate Reputation, which is a cloud-based service, which will basically collect the public certificates across the top 1 million websites in the world. We will collect those in a data store, and then we will be able to analyze the use of those certificates moving forward. So you can imagine on today, I get a list of all the certificates being used from all these top 1 million websites, and let's imagine tomorrow, in Dagestan, we now have Microsoft certificates showing up on some server out there. Right? We'll be able to know that because our service will know the origin of where certificates are being issued from. Not only that, when we receive these certificates, even if they look authentic, we can actually look within them, and there are things we can look at that may give us some insight on whether maybe they were fraudulently created. So maybe they look okay, but if you look very closely, maybe the algorithms were being used or the properties were being set on these. These issues may also give us indicators that they've been fraudulently created or are being fraudulently used. So our goal with this service, which in some respects is really not a Windows 8.1 feature so much because it's really a cloud service, is designed really to add trust to the public key infrastructure that's being used in the cloud. And we think that this is going to be an area of probably intense attack in the years to come. So we think we're really kind of getting ahead of that. Not that we've never seen attacks on this before, but probably not at the scale that we would say we couldn't liken it to what we saw with Slammer and Code Red and these types of things. So this is kind of a little bit of an offensive maneuver. So let's talk about protecting sensitive data. When it comes to encryption, We've had BitLocker in Windows for many years. In Windows 8, we moved BitLocker from Enterprise and we put it in Pro, so it's available there. We're able to do that because TPM is oftentimes on devices that are shipping with Pro, so that made sense there. Because of Haswell and because of some other work that's going to make TPM pervasive, we've decided to move device encryption, which is a variation of BitLocker. It's built on BitLocker technology, but it's automatic and it can't be configured like BitLocker, but it has the same kind of security and the same type of encryption. We've decided to move that technology, which was in Windows RT and Windows Phone 8, into every edition of Windows. So when you set up Windows on a device that's running connected standby architecture hardware, which means pretty much all tablets, things that are running Haswell processor, Atom processor, ARM processor, we're automatically going to provision device encryption on that device, regardless of the edition you have. If you want to use a third-party alternative, you can turn that feature off, and you can deploy a Symantec, McAfee, Sophos, or your favorite other encryption software. But out of the box, we want to make sure you're protected. Let's see. And that pretty much covers the feature set there. We haven't changed the nature of the way device encryption works. It's really identical to the way it was on Windows 8, but it's now on all editions. And so this is a big deal for us. We don't believe that PCs should not be encrypted anymore, because we're just in a place where you need to encrypt the software, the operating system, as well as the personal information corporate data. Just to clarify the difference between device encryption and BitLocker, device encryption is automatic. It uses the TPM-only protector. It can easily be converted to BitLocker, and converted is probably the wrong word, but I don't have a better one at this point. The moment you add additional protector options on top of a device that's been provisioned with device encryption, it becomes BitLocker instantaneously. So you don't need to decrypt or do any transformations. You just start adding BitLocker layers on top of that. So this is it's very easy to go from device encryption to BitLocker if you're a corporation that maybe wants to centrally manage the keys to centralize reporting with a product like Microsoft BitLocker Administration and Monitoring. So that's really the key difference there, is BitLocker allows you to add more capabilities on top of device encryption and is not automatic as well. All right, so let's talk about another feature here. So with BYOD, we have a situation where corporate data is being put on devices that are not well managed or managed at all. And once the data is on an unmanaged device, a corporation has really lost control of it. And so we have a lot of corporations are asking for functionality in Windows to help deal with this. And so we're delivering a feature called Selective Wipe, which is kind of an industry term. Selective Wipe gives a service the ability to basically remove corporate data while leaving the operating system and user data alone. And so the way this system works, in fact, I have a slide that kind of, I'll just jump to it here. Oh, actually, we've cut that slide, sorry. Basically, the way this works is an application, let's say like Exchange Server, when it provisions email to the mail application, Exchange Server will say, hey, I want this information to be encrypted with a Selective Wipe feature. The mail client will then is instrumented with the capability to implement the Selective Wipe capability, and will then, as soon as it receives email, it will encrypt that data. Today, it receives the data, but it's not encrypted. And Exchange can wipe the data, but it can't wipe it securely because it's not encrypted, right? So you can imagine on a Windows 8 device, it receives corporate mail. The mail app will delete the file, but if you use Dart, for instance, you could basically pull that file back out and you'd have access to that mail again. Because we encrypt it, it's irrecoverable once the keys are removed. So basically what happens is the mail app will receive it. It calls some APIs to encrypt it. The keys are stored in the credential locker. And then when it's time to wipe the data, the keys are removed from the credential locker, and then the data is left inaccessible. So the mail app will actually delete the keys and as well as the data. Another feature that's taking advantage of this functionality called work folders does not delete the data. And the reason why we don't always delete the data, we'll delete the keys so it's inaccessible but not the data, is because what if you're using a replication service? If you delete it on the client, you've also deleted it in the cloud. So it's really up to the application to decide how they handle the wipe. At a minimum, you're going to lose access to the data. If the app chooses to wipe the data, that's their choice and they can implement that capability. So the two features that ship out of the box with Selective Wipe capability are mail and work folders. The APIs are public. We're looking at companies like Adobe and the Office team are all thinking about adding this capability. So you'll see this across a wide array of the applications out there shortly after we ship. So let's go into malware resistance. So we've added a couple of pretty substantial capabilities here. The first is a feature area. This is not a name of a feature yet because we're still working on it. But what we want to be able to do is we want to be able to prove that a PC is healthy. And so there's a number of circumstances, even with UEFI, even with Trusted Boot and ELAM, which is the early load anti-malware driver, there are places where malicious software can insert itself and persist over time. And so one of the scenarios would be with Flame. So in the case of Flame, Flame used our signatures to sign a fake bootloader, and of course UEFI and Trusted Boot would never know that there's anything wrong there. So a feature area like provable PC health could actually detect a Flame, and basically here's how. What will happen is the client will collect a series of bits of information. In Windows 8, we had a feature called Measured Boot that wasn't talked about that often. But what Measured Boot does is it takes measurements of all the boot components as they're started. So the firmware in UEFI, the firmware in option ROMs, the bootloader, anything that's really started during the core boot process is measured, which is basically, think of it as like a hash. And we basically stored that information with the TPM. And that's kind of where the story of Measured Boot ends. The consumer, which is going to be this cloud-based service, is going to be able to harvest the Measured Boot data and take a look at that, because the client's going to send that up to the cloud for analysis. And if the cloud determines that there's something that's unusual on the machine, let's imagine that somebody has faked up a bootloader that we've never seen but signed it with a Microsoft signature, the service, because it has a database of all known measurements for all known UEFI firmware versions, as well as option ROMs, as well as all our own boot files, it would notice that, hey, that's interesting, that's a version of the Windows bootloader that never shipped from Microsoft. That's probably suspect, and at that point we can initiate a remediation action. The remediation action can be information that's sent to the device that will help the user get rid of the malware. Possibly the malware can be removed automatically. Possibly it requires additional steps, so maybe you need to use something like Defender Offline to boot to a remote USB and clean the system from a clean operating system. There could be a number of different scenarios, but this is going to be able to detect some of those really nasty viruses that are persistent and impossible to detect locally. So this is a pretty cool feature. It's going to be great for bring your own device scenarios, because right now with a BYOD scenario, you don't have the ability to manage it, and you have no control on whether the AV is even running or up to date, etc. And so you know as a corporation that the devices connecting to you because of this service are more likely to be healthy than they were in the past. Question? I'm sorry? Not at this point. So one of the things that's kind of an obvious limitation that I kind of mentioned is it is designed for consumer scenarios in BYOD. So that means it doesn't have like integration into like a system center and whatnot. That might represent a natural evolution. I can't disclose when we would do that, but that I think that was something that would make sense down the road. So I would love to see that.
I'll use the mic rather than shout.
Okay.
Why do you need this? If all your data is going into an encrypted, secured part of the file system that's protected and all the apps know what to do with it, then why does it matter if the device is safe or not? The data is protected inside of the device, right?
Well, if your device is encrypted, right, that just means that somebody can't access that volume is unauthorized. Malware comes from potentially coming from the internet.
Yep.
May be able to come to your system and run under the context of an administrator, and it might be able to insert itself in the system because of that. It may be able to exploit a vulnerability, right, in a system component that's running as system that has unlimited access system. So to be honest, the volume of the types of viruses that we're going to be able to prevent with this type of service is pretty low, because these are going to be the most sophisticated types. So it's not like we're going to be deflecting millions of different types of these things, but the ones that we do are going to be a very, very big deal. They're going to be like a Flame, or maybe a worse. Flame was targeted at a nation state, right? Maybe the next version of Flame is targeted at consumer devices or specific corporations, et cetera. So this is going to have a big impact, but won't be used very often. It's almost like a nuclear option, you might say. Rarely used, but very, very nice to have in the back pocket. Okay. So let's talk about some of the features that we have. In fact, let me step back here. This just kind of articulates how the process works. So what will happen is the client will periodically harvest the measured boot data. It will also harvest status information from Action Center. So it will detect, is my is Windows Defender running, or your third-party anti-malware solution? Is my firewall up and running? A number of other attributes are running. In fact, they'll also take hashes of the third-party kernel mode drivers, so things that start after Windows boots up. Those drivers also are pretty risky. We actually will take a look at those as well. Those all go up to the cloud. Cloud will analyze, and if it needs to respond, it can respond in two ways. It can respond with the machine remediation that I just mentioned a few moments ago and let you know how to get out of that bad state. But another thing that's really interesting is, well, what happens if that virus is a keylogger and maybe compromised your identity? Today, the software solutions that I'm aware of don't let you know about that threat unless you go read the information about the nature of the infection, which most people are just, I don't want to read that. I'm clean now. I'm not worried. Well, what we'll do is we'll let you know if your account has been compromised, and then we'll help you facilitate a remediation of your Microsoft account, which is a very nice feature to add to this. Go ahead. You have to buy the cloud service, but it's free. I'm being sarcastic. So this is a service that's part of 8.1. If you upgrade to 8.1, which is a free upgrade to 8, you get this for free. So this is not something we're going to ask for money for. So sorry for being sarcastic. Okay. Let's go to the last couple things here. So there's a couple of improvements here. One is in Defender, the other is in Explorer. Windows Defender, the challenge with things like Defender is you're always in this hamster wheel of new malware, new signature, new malware, new signature, goes on and on and on, right? Well, most of these types of malware that we see have familiar patterns of malicious behavior. We can add network monitoring behavior, which is what we've done to Defender in 8.1, and we were able to detect new viruses that we don't have signatures for using that technique. And so this is going to eliminate a lot of classifications of malware, because what we find is there are cookbook routines for many types of malware. And so the new ones that come out are almost oftentimes at the binary level very different, but the way they operate is oftentimes the same. So this will be very helpful. I'm sorry? Yeah, we're looking at the pattern of behavior. So we'd be looking at accesses to the registry, the file system, what's going on inside a process. There's a number of different things that they're looking at. But we take a pretty conservative approach to this. You know, the problem with behavior monitoring is false positives. And we can't have people getting a situation where, oh, here's another virus we've cleaned when we haven't. We don't want to block good applications. So we take a very conservative approach with this. But the idea is that, you know, signatures will eventually come out, but we can prevent the ones that we really have a lot of certainty about. So this is going to be pretty nice progress on that front. For Internet Explorer, this is kind of the last main feature we're going to talk about today, is so that we have binary extensions. We have things like ActiveX control and other things. And so when there's a vulnerability in that control, what happens is people who have websites like to attempt to send a payload that tries to exploit that vulnerability. So this is a common attack. And so the challenge is the payload comes to the control, and the control automatically runs it. And then the malware, the infection occurs, and then hopefully the anti-malware solution cleans it up. And so that's not really the right order, right? So what we've done is we've added hooks into the operating system that allow a anti-malware solution like Defender, a browser, to hook into this API, and they can basically receive the payload, send it straight to the anti-malware solution for scanning, and then if it looks good, then they execute it. So we get in front of the execution rather than behind it. It makes a lot of sense. You know, I wonder why we didn't get there earlier. It was a matter of priorities, of course. But yeah, it's kind of an obvious solution. But this will have a big impact because a lot of people are still using these binary extensions. So that pretty much kind of concludes the presentation. So. So it's an API that any browser can take advantage of. Yeah. So that represents the most key features. There's some other security features, but these really represent the things that I think will resonate, make the biggest impact. So I think you can tell it's a pretty thick layer of new capability that we've added. I don't feel like this feels super incremental. There's some big things we've done. I think provable PC health, you know, its ability to detect these horrible viruses that you would never detect once you had an infection is a big deal. Biometrics is going to change the way we use devices, obviously. Once that's on your laptop or your device, I mean, that's going to be so much better to authenticate. And so anyway, so that represents the changes. And so let's do some Q&A. We got 15 minutes. And so let's invite a few people on stage. Maybe Nelly, you might come since I know you got passionate about this. And we also have a couple gentlemen from Fingerprint Cards, Christian and Charles, who could answer some questions about the reader that I showed today. And just to be clear, Nelly Porter owns the modern access control feature area, so things like biometrics, virtual smart cards, and a number of other things kind of fall in her area. So come